Welcome to North 2, a production of Peaked FM. I'm your host, Corey Luna. With me is Richard Hogben. And today, I speak with MC Frontalot. Some of you may know he is the creator of the term nerdcore, which is rap about nerd things such as coding, video games, comic books, and everything that you grew up with that you never thought expected to become mainstream media. MC Frontalot in the late 90s brings the ideas into fruition of bringing the accumulation of the dot-com boom into rap music and bringing the dissociation of what the internet has become in 2019 of the breakup between him and the internet. Pun intended, of course. This is something that is dear to his heart, dear to my heart, and something that resonates with everybody in the world on the internet. Absolutely crazy. I had the wonderful opportunity of seeing MC Frontalot in person performing with Megaran back in 2023 at the D&A Lounge, where I got to photograph these wonderful performers as they performed, along with the opening act, Alice Knows Karate, a very cool local band out here in the Bay Area. Check out this conversation with the godfather of nerdcore, MC Frontalot. MC
Howdy. Frontalot. Howdy, hey. Hello. Howdy.
Frontalot, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
My pleasure.
May I call you Damien today?
Sure. I'll answer to anything. Hey, Baldy. Yo, Fatso.
So, coming from the Bay Area, it's nerdcore has, and since I've learned about nerdcore music back in the early aughts, it's been something that I've really enjoyed and continually enjoyed. Of course, growing up, listening to Weird Al Yankovic myself, and growing up watching Star Wars, playing Dungeons and Dragons, all of this, everything in the lyrics that you have produced and several other artists as well have really resonated with me. And it's always been a really fun time for me. And I've been able to bring my partner into it a little bit as well. My older brother was the first person who really introduced me to your music back in the early aughts. And I was able to come see your show with Megaran back in 2023 at the D&A Lounge on September 5th. Mm. Yeah. And that was a really fun show. You guys brought a lot of energy to the stage. Another friend of mine happened to be at the show as well, my friend Amy Lee, and which was really great. And I've actually got a book over there from Megaran from the show.
I see it in the blurry distance, his his original memoir.
Yeah, when he first put that out, I actually got a request from I put in a request to get it into the San Francisco Public Library, and they eventually did.
Nice work.
Thanks. So I want to start out with asking you about how do you feel about the evolution of your music as MC Frontalot, as you started out really pioneering the genre of nerdcore and up to your recent studio album Netsplit. We see the breakup and the dysfunction of the internet now that we've had it in our lives for over 20 years, and now that we're going beyond that into now with the evolution of AI really taking a big step into the mainstream. How do you see your work evolving and speaking to what's going on in technology?
Well, that's an involved question. I feel like maybe I'm in the early wave, especially when I'm putting the first demos online, starting at the very, very end of 1999. I feel like I'm in the, like, comfortably within the earliest wave of, like, internet musicians, like people whose, like whatever success we've had, over however many years, it's like all been within the internet era. Not just like, you know, I'm sure there was some egghead putting his demo out on DARPANET, but we don't know who that was. And there was no psychoacoustic audio compression at the time. So he was posting WAV files, and Lord help you if you could have downloaded that. But in the MP3 era, like artists who started when MP3s already existed and people knew how to play them, I think I'm in the first wave of those people. So I'm definitely like the evolution of my like music career has gone hand in hand with whatever's been going on online the whole time. And even though I changed from like just a bedroom musician posting MP3s in, you know, 2000 to like a national touring act in 2006, and ever since, like I'm an in real life musician, and I have been ever since then, but like I still feel like the people who are interested in what I do are internet people, just because they're nerds. But then, you know, like what an internet person is has very much changed over the last 25 years. And like that meant you were a serious like nerd kid. Like you really had to know some stuff and figure some stuff out just to like get online and locate a, you know, community of like-minded nerds on some Usenet group, find a web ring that had various BBSs that indicated your personal interests were shared by other humans out there. Like all that stuff made you feel kind of like, I don't know, like you were adventuring through a cave and finding other adventurers. In the year 2000, I think, still. And it was like a glorious and joyful experience. And then over the years, now everyone, just by nature of, you know, living in a part of the world where you have cell phone availability, like everyone is an internet person. Clearly not everyone in the whole world, but almost, right? I mean, are there 6 billion people on the internet? I don't know actually, but I feel like more people on Earth who are alive are internet people now than aren't. That's my feeling. That's my vibe-based statistical analysis. So yeah, what would it even mean now to be an internet musician? I think that would like why it would share some part of the earliest definition in that that still would indicate that you're a person who, like, someone who does not give a damn about anything that's ever happened online would have difficulty caring about that musician. I guess that would still be a useful definition of, like, an internet musician. But, like, I mean, Taylor Swift would not try to put a record out without, you know, an internet-first strategy, right? I mean,
yes,
no, nobody would. It's just become ingrained in the human experience. And certainly in the dissemination of pop culture in a way that it wasn't at the beginning. So I don't know. You pointed out that I have a whole record about breaking up with internet because the current experience of internet's like effect on everybody's mental health and also on world politics, like it's all more negative than it is positive these days. And it's hard to find the sense of, you know, foraging or adventure. I'm sure it's still out there. Hackers never lose that, but they're always like out at the corners of the internet doing things that no light could possibly land upon. The rest of us, people just like, you know, trying to post an MP3 or listen to an MP3 or find out what an MP3 used to be because people don't really use those anymore. Yeah, we're like in the glaring spotlight of how terrible most online stuff is in this day and age, and AI, as you mentioned, just going to make it all a lot more awful for everyone. I think it's just a big gateway to nobody knowing what's real, which we've already been struggling with.
Yeah, you know, that's I think you've just opened a giant door of like, well, what anyone really considers real anymore. Like with social media influencing so much of people's views and politics now, it's hard to, and now we have so much of it is considered fake news. How are we able to determine what's real and what's not anymore? Sure, there's some obvious things, of course, but when it comes down to information of like who said what, things like that, and being able to really decipher and understand information that is being broadcast to you through mainstream media, even that is now questioned. And I'm not even sure how we're able to help each other decipher what's factual and what's not, because possibly a lot of it is more about based on opinion now.
I mean, there's always been disinformation, misinformation, and propaganda, right? Like these are age old tools, but the internet has made it so much easier to lie to a billion people simultaneously. And even just on the surface level, like I feel like the generative AI stuff is making it so that you don't know if somebody with the voice of your friend on your telephone is like human at all. That could be a bot dialing 5 million people who's automated scraping the voice patterns of their friends off of their Instagram, you know, off of just scraping for scenes of parties and imitating the voices of other people at a party you were at and just cold calling thousands of people, trying to trick them into whatever, into Venmoing them $5, like whatever it is. The things that we used to understand were real on the surface, just through our basic human perceptions. And that has been, I think, traditionally the way to get around the kinds of misinformation that like have money and power behind them and that like are really kind of attacking us, attacking our psyches. Like that was the old method to deal with that, was to find a person who you know is real, who you trust for reasons in your life, and like see if you can lean on their expertise, right? And that used to be whatever, the Times and the Post and the professor or whoever down the street who you think is smart and well-informed. And those sources kind of disappear now. Like I used to type something into Google and find some documents, but now if I type something into Google, I have like a list of weird hallucinations that a robot made vaguely related to the topic of inquiry. And some of them will be labeled, here's a thing that I got from definitelyaccuratesource.com. And it reads as follows. And then you look up definitelyaccuratesource.com and it says the opposite or isn't registered. Domain doesn't exist.
Yep.
I feel like reality is falling apart more and more quickly. And I don't know if that's going to seem, you know, in retrospect in 100 years, like this is really a moment of extreme acceleration on that particular front, or whether that's at least in part amplified by the fact that I'm marching ever closer to the grave, getting older and older. And naturally, as we age, it seems to us that the world is changing more quickly. But I don't know. I'm only 51. I'm not supposed to like decay and expire for another 20 years or so, like minimum, right? I mean,
that's right. Or maybe 25. I have access
to nutrition.
That's right. And you know, those are great points of with this extreme advancement in technology that we use. To me, growing up reading lots of sci-fi, I see more and more resonate with the social commentaries that I was picking up on when I would read things like Neuromancer and Snow Crash. And although I really didn't read the Dune books, the Dune stories also, you know, take place in a time where they had, you know, there was already a war that happened with AI, so they don't use technology like that anymore, because of the dangers of it. And even in a lot of the writing that we've seen from the 60s and 70s of writing about AI, this artificial intelligence, it's already telling us back then, don't use it or be aware, be cautious of it, because this is going to emulate our personalities. It's designed to think like a human. So it's, and the nature of a lot of humans is not great, and it's going to bite us in the back. What do you think about that idea?
I mean, fortunately, we don't have any technology that thinks like a human currently, nor anything that like on the horizon that seems like it will. Like, Lord help us if they ever figure that one out. But I assume they will, right? I mean, they'll just grow a brain in a jar and like turn that into the computer and then get somewhere kind of close to like what our brains are doing. The thing we have now is it's just a bunch of math that's modeling. It's modeling language through trillions of guesses until it can like create a thing that we will mistake for real language and not, you know, the process of auto completing sentences or finding next tokens that are likely or whatever it's doing. But our brains are not ready to see the difference, right? Like if a computer can talk, which it can now, if a computer can just talk to you and seem to be, and like present something that is functionally identical to something a human has said to you in the past, then our brains are just not ready to be like, no, that's not intelligence. Like that's meaningless, whatever it is. That's a trick. That's some mirrors and some smoke, or something much more insidious than mirrors and smoke. It's like a tool where the machine can talk, but it's being directed by, you know, a fascist or a scammer or any kind of character we do not want to communicate with, who's tricked us into their little world, whatever that little world may be and whatever its aims may be, however nefarious.
So speaking about artificial personalities, I did comment on how much I like the background you've got on right now, but it's also, I realize it, you kind of look like Mitch, what was that character? Mitch Hedroom?
Max Hedroom.
Hedroom.
That is the background from Max Hedroom, upon which his floating head would always appear. He was a TV journalist, I think, the character
yes,
dies in the first episode, but his brain gets uploaded and it becomes this glitchy kind of simulation of himself, and he's a fully sentient AI that kind of floats around in the machine and helps his human companions like solve the mission of the week, whatever it is. It was a great show. We loved it as youngs, we who are now 51 years old.
So you've been on a tour recently. I think it's a little bit of a break right now, and then you're going to continue on with Schaefer the Dark Lord.
No, actually, our bit just wrapped up. So we did the East Coast and the West Coast, and we had a Montreal in between there. So we're done with that. I've still got, if this is airing in October, then I've still got nothing. I've got nothing scheduled after October. In that time, I will be working on my 8th album and trying to finish that up before the end of the year. But if this were airing when we're recording it, then I would still have PAX coming up and a hacker show in Oslo and a show with MC Chris on September 20th at Bottom of the Hill in San Francisco.
Wow. That's amazing.
But that's the end of my, I've been trying not to do shows at all because I want to get this record done. But also I have this thing where if I don't do shows as often as I'm able to, as I get offered them, then I lose my touch. Everything atrophies more rapidly these days.
Oh yeah. I know what you mean. It's sometimes it really takes a lot of effort to for me to just kind of get out of the house. And it's like, I don't want to go out, but I won't regret it if I do go out. It's more important that I actually go out and actually do these things. Like, we've got this show, you know, we've got our peaked 6-year anniversary show coming up on August 30th. And sometimes I'm thinking, you know, maybe nobody cares. I shouldn't do this. I should just stay at home. Nobody cares. But I'm wrong about that, because every time I go out and do it, the community comes out and supports, and it's always a wonderful time.
Yeah, isn't that a nice feeling? To burst out of your insular doubts and have an audience that will pat you on the back. Yeah, I think that's why I'm still touring after 20 years on the road.
That's an amazing thing. I'm glad you're doing it. It's something that I never toured myself, playing in bands. It was always local scenes for myself, but I'm always impressed with, you know, the friends of mine that I know who have gone out and done the tours. So I'm always impressed that you're still doing it and putting on these great shows. And I was curious about, with what is it like for you to look back on the shows when you first started out back in like the late 90s and aughts, as it started getting bigger and bigger? And what is it like now playing different venues compared to how it was?
Well, for the first several years, I always toured with my full band and never wanted to do a solo show with playback. I felt like that was, I mean, rappers had always been doing that. But I felt like, I don't know, I felt like a pretend rapper to some extent. I was comfortable being one of four people on stage. If the other three people on stage were making music with instruments, I felt like that could carry the show if I were, you know, not as good at rapping as I wanted to be, or not as, you know, endlessly engaging every moment of the show. It's like a lot of pressure to be up there all by yourself. And it's also, I don't know, there's something fundamentally boring about pressing play and having the same music come out that came out last night. But then eventually I, on the one hand, got over myself and on the other hand, worked up some amount of, you know, proficiency with the rapping and the stage presentation, just from having done it for however many years. And also, it's really expensive to bring three other people on the road and rent a big vehicle and a trailer and put everybody in hotel rooms. It's a lot easier to go around with your laptop. So I joined all the other rappers in the world, and I do it that way for the last, I don't know how many years, 15. We still put the band together for, you know, money shows. That are able to fly everybody out and whatever. We'll do mostly conventions. And sometimes Beard Science, who has drummed with me the most in recent years, will come on the road and do a little run, and we'll just do drums and voice and playback. Yeah, I don't know. You get better at anything that you do like a zillion times, and things that usually plague performers like stage fright and worrying about how good they are at it, like that stuff eventually gets just worn away from repetition, so that you don't suffer from it anymore. And also, I guess you do get better at stuff, right? Like the art itself. Get better at rapping over time. I think the height of the notoriety for my particular projects probably 10 or 12 years ago. Like that was when it was the easiest to fill up, like, you know, a 300 or 400 person room in San Francisco or Boston, Seattle. Those were the best cities. This last tour, we played to a few great crowds and a lot of kind of modestly sized crowds. It's like, oh yeah, I'm like an old man. I've been Nerdcore's 25 years old. I'm a legacy act. The folks who come out are like bring enough enthusiasm for a big room. And they definitely make every show well worth doing. But, you know, you have to reckon with a little something if you were performing for crowds that were 3 to 5 times bigger, you know, 10 years ago. You're like, oh, does like nobody care anymore? Well, clearly some people care. And the same thing is true that has always been true of the nerdcore audience, which is that they are really eager to support the endeavor and they buy 5 times as much merch as other indie band audiences. And that is like what makes it possible to go out and, you know, play for 50 people every night, 50 to 100 people every night. That's what makes it still work is the merch. Merch is life, unfortunately. Or I feel fine about it. I was a designer before I was a musician. So I actually, when I sell t-shirts, I kind of feel like, you know, people are appreciating my couture.
That's really cool. Because, yeah, you're in the t-shirt business.
Yeah, I have a song about on that topic.
It's a good song.
Thanks.
I was also curious about how has Weird Al Yankovic influenced your music personally?
Well, I certainly grew up on Weird Al. I think In 3D was probably within the first 3 or 4 cassette tapes that I ever bought for myself, like at the mall, saving up my own allowance until I could afford a tape. And I was a huge fan all throughout my youth. And I think I forgot about him a little, probably in college in my 20s. So like, that's, you know, the late 90s to the early aughts. And then like, I don't know, everyone who like me grew up on him kind of came of age and we all started making our own art careers and just, I don't know, his like, his reputation is just sterling now in everyone's, I feel like the low tide for Al's, like, for like Al getting respect from the world was sometime, I wish I knew, would know what year this was, but I remember an Onion article just ruthlessly mocking his approach to song parodies. And it was like him getting up in the morning, trying to decide what to do with Livin' La Vida Loco by what's his name? The guy from Menudo. Oh, Ricky Martin. Ricky Martin. Yeah. And then he's like, what am I going to do? Well, Livin' La Vida Mocha at Starbucks. That's it. I'm calling it a day. And it was so dismissive and so sort of like encoded with the idea that if you ever liked Weird Al's approach, you were a dumb little kid. And I remember feeling bad reading that. Like, I really liked The Onion. And then I remember feeling bad reading that. It was like, I felt bad for Al. I felt bad for myself, even though I hadn't really thought about my Weird Al fandom in years. And I don't know. I got this kind of like, should I be looking more at like how mean The Onion is? should I be a more critical Onion reader? Because I don't like this. And then I feel like that was the nadir. And then graph going up since then. And they, I mean, everyone who's ever seen his live show speaks of how it's among the greatest live shows anyone's ever seen. And he's still full force doing that. And they gave him a bunch of Grammys recently. It's like something happens to you when all your child fans grow up and make their own art, because they're the tastemakers of the world for that generation. And if they all speak of you in reverent hushed tones, then you're an old god all of a sudden. There's like carve some statues, tell the villagers to be scared of the lightning because you're that important now. And that's like, that's what I think of Weird Al that way now. I feel like The Onion would quake in their boots to take a shot at him right now. Because everyone loves Weird Al.
Yeah. It's,
I probably more what your question was is like, how has he influenced my art? Like, I mean, I never did any parody work myself, at least not in public. I certainly write little parodies of everything that comes into my ears, like quietly to myself. I can't help it. His originals, being like always jumping. And they're, I mean, sure, they're just sort of genre pastiche, but they're also like, they're good songs and they're funny and they're not parodies. And I don't know. I listened to a variety of comedy things as a kid that all had musical components, but I can't think of another like comedian slash musician who I was a fan of. It's like, it's really Weird Al created my whole sense of having that kind of fun with music where you're setting out to make a piece that is itself funny. And I'm almost exclusively keep that kind of songwriting to like Song Fight and my non-Frontalot stuff. But I think the sense of humor that I want all music to have, I got at least in part from Weird Al, and I definitely bring that to the Frontalot material.
Very cool.
That's my very long answer.
Yeah, that's fantastic. It's what I'm looking for. It's it makes a lot of sense to me. And for me, you know, it's growing up as a kid, Weird Al Yankovic was always there. And I heard his parodies of a surgeon and fat. I heard all these all these great parody songs before I ever heard the originals. And then I would grow. And then as I got older as a kid, I'd hear the originals and go, Oh, it's Weird Al. And to me, it's like, this is great. I'm like, oh, okay. I didn't know what the original lyrics were. So this is what he was parodying. And I just enjoyed it even more. The fact that he's so good at creating parodies that are not, you know, they're more tongue in cheek. They're not gouging. Right. And sure. This is something that, I mean, maybe there's a little bit here and there, but overall, like to me, I always just enjoyed it. It was something fun. It made music fun and inviting to you at an early age for me, which is great. And I always appreciated his work. And as you said, like, you know, there was a point where he kind of, his pastiche was not there for a moment. And like people kind of forgot about him. And even there was Austin, the first Austin Powers movie, they've got like a scene of like other celebrities that have had that are cryogenically frozen, and Weird Al was in there. And this was like 1997. So, but to me, it's like, well, Weird Al has always been great to me, and not everyone really understood his humor throughout the years, maybe, but there was a time maybe from the late 90s into up until maybe 2015 when he put out Mandatory Fun that really brought him back up, and he's been riding it ever since. And he's continued because he's always been the same guy. He's always been like that. And it just took the mainstream media to recognize that again, for him to influence another generation of people to capture and enjoy the music that he's always produced.
Yeah. Agreed. I think I was actually talking about that question with Schaefer, the Dark Lord, as we drove around on tour last month. Like, which songs did you know the Weird Al version before you ever heard the pair of, which of Al's parodies did you know before hearing the original song? And everyone's got a few, at least. I know for me it was Our Love's in Jeopardy. Like, that, I missed that one being on the radio. Either I was too young or it didn't play in the Bay Area, but I didn't know that one. I knew I lost on Jeopardy.
Yeah.
Until years later. And others. I think maybe Stop Dragging My Car Around before I ever heard the Tom Petty, Stevie Nicks. there might have been more. There might have been two or three more. It's funny. The cultural awareness of a child audience, like, you're really shaping their brains. If you're making stuff that they love, like, you're really you're showing them the whole world through your lens, whatever your lens is. They won't see the source until later.
Absolutely. And another big influence on me as a teenager and then growing up, and which was big to a lot of my friends as well, which I didn't realize until I started doing some more research, listening to some other podcasts you've been on, is that you're a Tom Waits fan. And myself, also a Tom Waits fan. Mill Variations was a really fun album for me. And of course, I love Rain Dogs, Small Change, Swordfish Trombone. And I was curious if you got around to listening to his album, Glitter and Doom, that he put out a couple of years ago. And
yes, I listened to Glitter and Doom. I listened to Alice and Blood Money and that whole 3-disc Orphans set. I think I've certainly bought and listened to every Tom Waits record that I've ever been aware of. I don't know if he's slipped one by me at some point. There are a few that are harder to, nothing's hard to find anymore because you look up on Wikipedia and find an exhaustive list of everything ever published by any artist. But at the height of me trying to get a hold of like physical media versions of every Tom Waits thing, there were some things that were harder to find, some like foreign releases that had maybe very little material on them that were unique to that release. Things like, even things just like the soundtrack to whatever that movie is, One from the Heart, that he did with Crystal Gale. It's not good. I don't like it anyway. But it's a Tom Waits record, and it's got something on there that's like, you know, something. It's got something on there that you really wouldn't want to miss. I think You Can't Unring a Bell is maybe from that. Don't quote me on that. But But big Tom Waits fan. For me, I started with Small Change. My friend played me Small Change at the end of high school. A Step Right Up, of course, the first track off of it that he played for me, that was like, I was just like, I'm on board. That's for me. I think the run from Swordfish through Bone Machine, that's like those four records. I feel like those are just perfect. Like, all of them are perfect. You just like put on the first track of Swordfish Trombones and like let it run through the end of Bone Machine and just pretend that's one long 4-album long record, and you would never skip a single track.
That's really cool. Yeah, Going Out West really resonates with me off of Bone Machine.
Yeah, that's a good song. And a thing that's good about that song is it's often the only Tom Waits track that will be available at a karaoke bar that they'll have in the machine. So you can always sing it in public in almost any town.
Have you done
this? If you're willing to. Oh, sure, yeah. I've sung that at a lot of karaokes.
Nice. Do you do it in... I assume you probably do it in Tom Waits' voice.
Well, you know, you start doing it in the Tom Waits voice and you realize about 2/3 of the way through that only Tom Waits can do that voice for a whole song. Yeah. But you still try. I know karate. Voodoo 2. Gonna make myself available to... I'm already dry.
Yeah. No, I couldn't do it. That'd be tough. But that was just a great experience to me. And your music is very different, but I was curious if there's elements that have maybe from Tom Waits that have influenced something that you have released in your music.
I probably have said this before in an interview, but maybe long ago, I've seen in Tom Waits, especially in those four albums I mentioned, like Swordfish, Rain Dogs, Frank's Wild Years, and Bone Machine, there will be elements of all kinds of familiar American music, but the grooves and the production and the arrangements, you know, the instrumentation, those will not sound like they're of the time. Like Rain Dogs, it has Downtown Train, which is like a proper pop arrangement that sounds like it's from 1986. But nothing else on that record sounds like it's from 1986. It's not like weird or experimental. It's just out of time. And that makes a record that never sounds dated, like ever. And I've definitely always wanted to do that. to what success I've managed it, but that has always been a goal in the back of my head, because of Tom Waits, to make grooves that are not going to sound dated because they don't have any element of what's in fashion right now, and to do music production and make mixing choices that are not like currently trendy. And hip hop in particular, like, suffers from that. Like, there's always, you know, the new current trend in how beats are made and what they sound like. They get sparse, they get busy. Snares and toms sound a certain way. Even certain rhythms will just pop up on every hit record for 2 years and then disappear, because now a record with that rhythmic pattern on it sounds like it's 2 years old, and you can't have that in the hippest music that there is. So I've always like, and that's part of what nerdcore affords you also, right? Like, it's anti-hip. You don't have to be hip. You can try as hard as you can not to be hip. And that, I hope, gives you this kind of shelter from the storm of ever sounding like dated and old. Old timey is different, right? You might be making something that sounds old timey on purpose. And a lot of Tom Waits kind of is like that, but it sounds like a weird old timiness from another dimension, you know, these fractured grooves, banging on anvils and kitchen implements. Sounds like a radiator getting emptied out or something, and that's part of the groove. So even if he's just doing a bossa nova that was popular in the 60s, it's like, it sounds weird and you don't know when it's from if you had no context. Anyway, I've always aspired to that. I don't know how much I've succeeded in doing that on the records, but that's something I always wanted for myself because of him.
I think some of it does come out in the productions and the arrangements you work with your team, because from what I understand, you always work with a live drummer when you're going to produce an album, you know, going to record. You've got a live drummer, you've got a synthesizer, you've got a keyboard arranger as well to create the actual music. So it sounds like you're working in collaboration with your musicians to create a particular sound you want on each song and throughout one record. And as you, I think you've also mentioned in previous interviews that you don't use samples in your tracks, which I might not be correct on that.
Certainly in the very beginning when I was making those demos that I never thought anyone would ever want to buy a rap album by me, and everything I put out was made of samples back then. But since the first CD in 2005, yeah, no samples on the records. Just because I don't want to call up anybody who owns those master recordings and like try and negotiate with them and pay them a bunch of money. And I also don't want, I mean, I love hip hop and I love where it comes from artistically. And I believe that collage is a real art form, you know, but it was for some reason, just because of my ego, it would like kill me if the best thing on one of my albums was like a groove that was really from someone else's album, you know?
Yeah.
Like that would just always make me feel kind of like, ah, God damn it. Why'd I do that? And obviously there's a lot of hip hop producers who use samples so transformatively that's never the case, even if the music like is entirely taken from five other records and all those records are classics and greats. Like they may be making something where the groove itself is so new and different that you would never think that. But a lot of the hip hop that's made the most money, I'm thinking of stuff that like P. Diddy used to put out, will have these sort of just wholesale lifts of the best part of some much better song.
Yep.
And that'll be the thing that's good about the new song, you know?
Yeah.
It certainly won't be Diddy's rapping. It'll be, you know, it'll be that he did a good job, like, picking an old disco record or an old funk record to just lift the chorus out of and use that as the loop for the whole song and do almost no flipping on it. And that, like, I don't know. I never wanted that to be something someone thought when they listened to one of my records. I'd rather have them think all of the songs are mediocre than think, oh, I like that one, except that it's like, isn't that Tom Waits song? I'm just going to go listen to that Tom Waits song. It's better.
Yeah. No, I think it's really great that you yourself have kept up that originality with the music arrangements, with the collages that you do with your musicians. I think it really stands out. And this is what makes your records sound unique and good, that you have this wonderful original production of working with musicians who know how to create and work together to create this beautiful sound.
Well, thanks.
Well, it's very good. It stands out a lot. And you know, even the style that you rap in is, to me, sounds original. I can't think of another rapper that has your flow in the way that you perform and deliver lyrics.
Well, thanks. I started out like every rapper, I think, just kind of aping the styles of all my favorite rappers. And then I don't know, everybody's own voice kind of, and style emerges through that process. Eventually there's something, sometimes rappers ask me how to, like sometimes aspiring rappers will ask how to, you know, develop a style that's distinctive in their own. And I tell them a piece of advice that I don't know if any other rappers hand out, which is this: like, start with the comp, like sit down and hack together a rap performance out of tons of different takes or little short takes, and like craft it using the audio, just like you were making a collage, like with the glue, and make a performance out of it that sounds the way you wish you sounded when you rapped. And then teach yourself to deliver this like thing that you've Frankensteined that started out not being real, like make it real through force of practice. Cause it's all just made out of you and noises you can make. You just have to figure out how to make them with the like rhythmic precision that you revealed to yourself through the editing process, or the like dynamic range that you revealed to yourself, or like all the different things that you can't necessarily do in one take when you're starting out, because you're just concentrating on getting through it, you know, or remembering your lyrics or whatever you're like wrestling with as a noob. And then, yeah, I think that's a technique that a lot of people could benefit from. But it's like, it sounds real shitty to a lot of rappers who think that the only point of rapping is to be able to like go through it live. Like that's your whole worth as a rapper. And it is when you're on stage. But in the studio, it's a different beast. And when you're trying to figure out what you will someday be doing on stage, that's going to be compelling. Like use your computer tool, especially if you're a nerdcore rapper, like work backwards from the fake and make it real.
Yeah, very good advice. And you know, that kind of goes with anything of like, you need to put in the hours and the work to get to where you want to be. And you don't even, and you might not even be creating what you thought you were creating once you get there. You might be doing something slightly different or completely different.
Yeah. And that's a piece of advice that's good for anybody making art, I think. Yeah, let it be and become whatever it's gonna.
So you were a graphic designer before becoming MC Frontalot. So now I'm curious about your album covers. Are you designing those?
Let's see. I certainly did not do any of the illustration. I got a dream team of various illustrators who I admired to do those album covers. But I guess you would call me the art director on them. Like I had the concept for each of them, except for the one that Mike Krahulik did. He came up with that completely. That's the 2001 scene. With my face in the space helmet, and instead of all the stars, it's like the EQ meter, the meters of the different bands on like a stereo or a mixing board. the rest of them, I think I started with the concept, and even in a lot of cases did a little doodle for them. I did not send any, I did not have the balls to send any doodles to Bill Sienkiewicz, but I described a bunch of the stuff that was happening on the Fairy Tale record, like the different stories that I was telling in the songs. And I wanted him to just pick one. I'm like, here's like, you know, 10 things you could do for the album cover. I was like way too much. I was probably real stoned when I was writing him this direction, but he took it and did it as 9 panels. And it's like, oh God, I'm getting like 9 album covers from Bill Sienkiewicz. But his concept was to do it as sort of a Little Nemo strip, which I did not supply him with that idea. That was his reaction to the album concept. So
that's really
cool. I sent a doodle to Tony Moore. I sent a doodle to Jonan. I sent a doodle to Evan Dorkin. I sent some doodles to Scott C. I don't think I sent a doodle to Malky. I think I might just describe to him what I wanted, and he nailed it better than any doodle I would have even suggested. Wow. Maybe I did send him a doodle. I don't know. I can't help it. I send doodles.
Drawing's a good thing to do. Or doodles.
Yeah. And I do I have done the typography on them.
Did you?
For the most part. Yeah. Mostly.
That's really cool.
Final boss one. That's Scott C. did that lettering. I think the rest of them, I did all the typography that's on the covers.
It's a lot of work.
Not as much work as illustrating.
Yeah, that's true.
Just something it's not in my skill set.
Very cool. So I'm getting close to the end of our conversation. So you've got, I assume you probably have an album concept coming soon, but I was curious about.
Yeah. Album 8, it's called Counterfeit Wine. And loosely the theme of the album is ripping off billionaires. So we'll see. We'll see if that's toothy enough. We don't have to veer farther into the disabling and destruction of billionaires within the the actual songs. It's a time for getting rid of billionaires just at the moment.
Yeah, I can see that very much. Very cool. Well, Damien, MC Frontalot, thank you so much for being on North 2 for Peak.fm.
Thank you for having me.